just gone 25 to 2. It's time for our winner's enclosure, into which we invite the people who make stuff like this happen.
Listen to the roar! He's going to do it again! Pure, pure magic!
Oh! There's an obstruction to take it out!
This week, a defender who won pretty much every domestic trophy going during his time at Old Trafford. Two Premier Leagues, an FA Cup, a League Cup, Community Shield, 19 caps for England too, and played in that game in the 1990 World Cup in Italy. His name's Paul Parker, and it's great to have you on, Paul. Lovely to speak to you. Tell me when it was you first felt like a winner, when you first got a taste for winning.
I would have to say, really, the League Cup final, my first ever final, first professional final at Manchester United. That's when I really did feel like I'd gone and done something. Something that I dreamt about was playing at Wembley and actually winning at Wembley. And I think there is a bit there which is on film somewhere, showing me everything's going on around me, and I was just staring in my hands at the medal for seconds longer than everyone else. I think everyone else is a little bit more blasé because they had previous couple of seasons they'd won a cup, Winners' Cup, and an FA Cup.
And what about as a kid? There must be some schoolboy triumph for, you know, when you were playing, I don't know, where were you playing when you were 10, 11, 12 years old? There must be moments there you can still bring a smile to your face.
You know, I was very fortunate. I played for a team out of Dagenham called Romford Juniors, and we was a very strong outfit, and we had a lot of players who were training with pro teams, and that was only once a week. It wasn't like it is now where it's virtually three nights a week, and we was just virtually unbeatable in Essex. So every, you know, we was always in Essex Cup finals against teams out of East London, and it was very, very competitive. The teams that we played against out of East London had players who were mainly connected with West Ham, Chelsea, Arsenal, Tottenham. It was quite a battle, but that was when I was very fortunate, excuse me, to have been playing regular and just playing kids' football and winning games.
It's interesting. You were in a winning groove. And I just, would it have been different? I mean, you would have still been the same player, I suppose. You'd been playing for a less successful side. But would that have meant you would have gone on to achieve less necessarily?
It was always, for me, I always made my mind up that, first of all, I wanted to be a professional footballer. I gave up the opportunity to learn in school, just believing that's what I wanted to do, and that's all I needed to do, is be a footballer for the rest of my life. But I always wanted just to play in a big game, an FA Cup final, because that's the only real live game I can remember as such as a young kid. But I just wanted to play for the biggest teams possible, the biggest team. And the biggest teams at the time I can really remember, the regular ones, was a Tottenham or Manchester United, because they're the kind of teams you saw in FA Cup finals. That's what I can remember. And I was lucky enough to have played for Manchester United in two finals. So that was me as a kid, really. I always one of them who look at, if you've got an opportunity to go to and play at the highest level, you go and try. At the worst, you can come back to where you come from.
In your book, Tackling the Game, you talk incredibly powerfully about your childhood and school days and so on. And when you were in East London in Forest Gate, which is sort of proper East London, isn't it? And you moved out into what is on paper a nicer area in Essex. Is that right?
Yes, we did. We moved from there. We moved to Raynham in Essex, and my mum decided she didn't want us. She just wanted us to have a chance, really, rather than living in East London. So we moved to Raynham, and Raynham just borders Dagenham, which at the time we called it the GLC, and Dagenham had the biggest National Front following in the GLC. So it wasn't always pleasant. It was difficult, but I always say that it made our family. It made my sister and me two brothers. It made us what we are today, to be perfectly honest.
But it caused moving out to Essex was meant to solve that problem, being in, you know, make things easier for you. But it seems to have caused, in terms of racism and so on, it seemed to have caused as many problems as it solved.
I look at it that it brought up things, but it made us tougher as mentally as kids and as a family. But if we'd have lived in inner London, I don't know if I would have come out and had the opportunity to have been a professional footballer if I'd have been in inner London, to be honest, really. I don't know what could have happened to me.
Why would that have been?
I look at it because I've talked about this quite a lot lately, is that I've played against some incredible black footballers against them, East London sides, and they were really good players. And all through my journey, from every bit I've gone along, I haven't seen any of those players anymore. The lads who play for the likes of your Shadwells, your Tigers, and your Sam Rabs, all those kind of kids. I haven't seen any of them. Didn't see any of them as I was going through my bit. So I wonder where they've gone. I've got a good idea what happened to them in certain ways and maybe what they got involved in. But as footballers, I don't think they got the opportunities, or they weren't allowed to have the opportunities.
I mean, I spoke to Brendan Batson about this many times, and I'm sure you've met Brendan. And he was from an earlier era than you, and he was from Walthamstow. And he said, look, I made it, and I proved it was possible, though it was really hard. But he said, you've got to remember, you know, he said, for every player like me, there was another 100 young black kids who never got the chance, if only because their parents wouldn't let them out of the house to go and play football because of all the abuse they might get. So I've sort of never forgotten that. And it sounds that's slightly on your mind as well.
Yeah, it is that way. I mean, my parents weren't too pleased about it, but they weren't going to stop me. I did everything on my own. I was jumping on the back of buses to get close to the station, then jumping off because of I didn't have enough money for the fare. When I saw the conductor, I had to jump off early. When I come back from training, I had to... especially when I trained at Arsenal as a kid, I had to jump off the bus at Elm Park Station. So I'd jump across the road and wait until the bus was virtually up the hill, then run in front of it and get onto it because there was a pub full of skinheads at the end. So I had that to deal with. But I didn't go home and talk about it, because if I talked about it, I would never be allowed to go.
But, I mean, look, we won't dwell on this any more than you want to, but, you know, you were at risk. You were vulnerable. There was the possibility of serious violence being visited upon you because you were a black teenager.
Yeah, there was that bit there, but I think when you're young, you don't really feel it in that sense of, like, now, blimey, I wouldn't even want to contemplate anything like that now. But when I was that young and it was in my head that I was going to be a footballer, and I say this a lot, that nothing was ever going to stop me, or nothing was going to prevent giving me the opportunity to become what I wanted to be. And that's the reasons why I've done what I've done.
So it sounds like there was never any doubt in your mind you were going to be a professional footballer. I mean, when did that start to come true? When did you get the tap on your shoulder about going to Fulham?
When I was about 10, 11 years of age, really, and it was from playing for Romford Juniors, at that kind of level, there was no bigger level. That was the top level of kids football, playing for Romford Juniors, and the league we was in. We was in an East London league, a competitive league, not like the Essex leagues. And so you was going to get noticed there. But the team I played for, it had a coach who had an association with Fulham. Fulham had a training camp in Manor Road, Dagenham. And it worked out well for me. It was, a mile and a half maybe from my house. Sometimes I could get the bus, sometimes didn't have money, so I had to kind of walk and stuff like that. And once I got the expenses, it was a case of, do I get the bus back or do I buy some sweets to walk home with? Well, generally I did the latter, to be perfectly honest, but that's where I was. And there was a few other lads there. Gary Lewin was there for quite a while before he decided Arsenal come in and took him. Dean Coney, me and him played together from from Romford Juniors all the way until Queen's Park Rangers. He was there as well. Ray Parler was at Fulham for a little while as well before he went to Arsenal. So, we, you know, it was well established at that time, that training facilities, that once a week training facilities.
Mm-hmm. And so you played, I don't know, getting on for 300 games in West London for Fulham and then for QPR. Were you improving as a player? Who was teaching you? Who was helping push you on?
I think I look at it. I mean, I definitely improved as a player. I mean, more than the fact that my game changed from when it was at Fulham, which was predominantly third division football, two seasons in the second division. But then it was Ray Hartford, you know, God bless him, who was the main person who kind of grabbed hold of me at the professional level and told me a few home truths about myself and what, you know, and the reasons why he was doing what he's doing. So I took it personally as he didn't like me, but he did it because he always says that he hated wasted talent. And he just saw me as someone who was relying too much on what I saw as my strengths rather than working on my weaknesses. And he kind of woke me up a little bit. And then the opportunity to go and play for QPR, which I was kind of had no great choice in it because of what was happening at that time between the two clubs. But it was the best ever move I could have, really. I was able to bed myself in as a third division player into the first division. And I had one season on the plastic pitch. I think my body still shows bits of that plastic pitch. Yeah. But it helped bed me in playing in the first division up against players that I used to watch on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. And look, all of a sudden, you then pick for England, you know, right at the right time. 1989, was it a friendly against Albania? Bobby Robson liked the look of you. I mean, how did that feel?
Well, I mean, it was my only competitive game as a goal because it was a qualifier at Wembley. I got 15 minutes. That was my only competitive appearance before that World Cup. But I got into the squad in 88. Bobby Robson was one of them that even if his mum asked for a cap, he wouldn't give her a cap. She would have to earn it. And I sat in the stand for a few games. Then I sat on the bench for a few games. And then Bobby Robson gave me my substitute appearance, and that's how it worked out from there. I turned up at a World Cup expecting to be my squad number was 12. It's 12, which I generally always got given when Bobby Robson picked me anyway. And I wasn't going to play. It was as simple as that. It was something, you know, it was a shot in the dark, really, but I managed to play 6 out of 7 games.
Mm-hmm. And you're there for that massive semi-final. I mean, there were two key moments. You're involved in both of them. The ball was deflected off you for the German goal from that free kick. And I was shocked to read in your book, but people were still blaming you for that. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. But anyway, here's the bit of the commentary from that World Cup semi-final.
It's direct. And it's been deflected. And it's in the net. Bremer's shot. I'm sure that span off Paul Parker and beat Peter Shilton in the most circumstances.
Well, unfortunate is the word. I mean, who's blaming you for that? What were you supposed to do?
I did what I was supposed to do. And you tell me a person, or a man, I should say, who would run out there, spread themselves as wide as possible, and I turn around and tell you somebody who's not thinking right. And so people, you know, I mean, even now, sometimes, still on quite a few occasions, I go out and people who recognise me, someone will say something, and you get the ones who say it and they want to torture, they, you know, a laugh and a joke, and then you move on with other stuff. And you've got the ones who try and stir it still and say little things. And generally what I do is I turn it into a laughable conversation because, as you already know, I'm not big enough to fight anybody. Yeah. That's what it is. But at the end of the day, if it's still giving me notoriety at the age of 61, I can't really complain.
And then, I mean, there was redemption. You had a role in Gary Lineker's equaliser, came from a crossfield ball, delivered, I should say, by one Paul Parker. We've got a bit of that commentary.
They were appealing for offside. The Germans, and they're in trouble. Augenthaler couldn't do it. Lineker probably could. And England have equalised. It's Gary Lineker.
There you go. And that was your ball, which was some relief to you.
Oh, just a bit. I needed it. I was in a little bit of a place, excuse me, at that time as well. I was reading all the headlines. I was feeling everything at that time. All the things that were going to be said about me if we were to go out. And it took me a good 5 minutes to get my head together, really. And when I think about it, I think it was Peter Beardsley and Gazza, the first ones to me, because I think they saw it as well. If there was an opportunity for me to go missing after that moment, I was trying to find it. So when I put in, and when people talk to me about it, I call it a percentage ball. It's just one of those balls where I just put into an area and then you just hope that something happens. The bonus was two Germans missed it. It's come off of Gary's left thigh or left foot. I'm not really sure, but it ends up in the back of the net. So for me, that was an added bonus, really. But the worst thing about after all that is that 120 minutes of that game, it was that one game where we played actually our best football, and we never got what we deserved out of it. No.
But look, the World Cup wasn't to be then, ultimately. But all your winning was about to start happening. You moved to Manchester United and you went on to win every domestic trophy. What are the winning moments that stick out for you there?
My first, professional medal, which I mentioned earlier. Yeah. But I think the first league title was a big one, because as a kid, during my generation or our generation and ones before me and maybe slightly ones after, the FA Cup was the biggest game of the season. That FA Cup final is where you got to know all the individuals, you got to know everything about football in general over their road to that competition, to get to the final of that competition. It was just great to be involved in. But winning the league, you suddenly realise that football is about a marathon. And what you put into that marathon, the blood, sweat, everything that you go through. And I found that all out when we missed out in 91-92. And I saw that went with it, and what it was to be at a club like Manchester United when you fail on the line. But to go and win it and then to win the first Premier League title was something that, it still sticks to me. It's never going to be forgotten. And it was an incredible achievement of that given time, because we went through almost the same moments when we lost the title. But with this time around, you suddenly realise to win leagues, you have to have some experience of negativity to be able to fight through it. And that's what we had.
So you'd move from centre-back to right-back now. I mean, who did you enjoy playing with the most as you looked along the defensive line from the right back position?
From a right back position, the only people I could remember in a right back position was, most of the time was a few times at Fulham was Tony Gale. But if I look at Manchester United, I was very fortunate to play with Steve Bruce. When people talk about Bruce with me, they forget what he was like as a man off the pitch. But on the pitch, you talk about a leader, Bruce, he was. He wasn't quick. His brain was quicker than his feet. That was an added bonus. His organisation skills on the pitch. I just knew I had to be there and do a bit of legwork for him. But when it came to anything about dealing with anything physical, you'd always go to him. He was dangerous in both boxes, Brucey. It was just about his willingness to want to win the ball. And that's the reason why at one time he got 15 goals in one season from being a centre-half. So he was my most favourite person to play with as a fullback.
And what about Alex Ferguson as a manager? What did he bring to your game?
He just taught me about every single day is you want to achieve high standards every single day. You want to be involved in winning every day. That's the thing about it. When you won something, if you stared at it too long, he would virtually ask you what you're doing, and you'll come out and say, I'm looking at it. Then he's virtually then telling you, well, what you do is you make sure you go and win another one to look at that one and put that one aside and forget about it. And that's one of those things. It's a winning instinct. Sir Alex was all about winning. That's what mattered to him. Winning that time was great, but the day after, it's forgotten and you move on to your next challenge.
So it sounds like it was about motivation as much as sort of tactical stuff. I mean, who were the coaches that you were working with there? Or was, you know, Alex Ferguson important in that sense too?
No, I mean, Gaffer knew what he wanted, always knew what he wanted, but he was very fortunate on very clever, because he always worked with different coaches. But I look at the fact of, I went there and it was Brian Kidd, and I always called Brian Kidd the pacifier. He's the one that would come round after when you've had, if you're fortunate enough to only have one ear ripped off by the gaffer, when he come at you, he would actually talk you over exactly everything that was actually, you know, told to you in a different way. A very strong Glaswegian accent. Kiddo was an absolute fantastic coach. I hadn't had a coach like him at club level ever before, who coached in his manner and talked in a way. And when he joined in with you as well, what a fantastic player. He still was then when he was coach of Manchester United. There was him and Jim Ryan. There was Nobby Styles. There was Pop Robson as well, who was there. And I never really appreciated those people. I took it for granted. Those people, a World Cup winner. And then there was Brian Pop Robson, a great goal scorer, Sunderland, West Ham. I never really appreciated them until that they were there, you know, at Manchester United.
And who did you like playing against least at that time, coming at you down the left or the right to you? Obviously.
Yeah, it was attacking on our right hand side. The person who, it wasn't always that difficult for me as a fullback at United, because everyone was more worried about Andre Kanchelskis in front of me. Or maybe Giggsy would come across there, or even Lee Sharp would come across there. So it was always about trying to quell the storm with Manchester United going forward. But not me. I was an out-and-out defender. I was quite happy to defend. But the person who caused me a lot of problems, and it's not a household name, his name was Rick Holden. And he played for Oldham Athletic. And he caused me so many problems, because he was a bit like a modern-day John Robinson at Nottingham Forest. He just loved to hug the touchline, and he had this strange way that you thought you were closing down and you managed to hook one of his long, gangly legs around to be able to cross behind you.
Yeah.
And that's when I found about the vocal side of Peter Schmeichel, who hated crosses. He did not want anyone to cross a ball. The centre-halves didn't, because that meant there was a chance of getting their noses broken. But Peter Schmeichel didn't want to cross against him, didn't want shots, because he hated shot, because there was always a chance or anything that he was going to concede.
I mean, it's amazing.
Like,
so
doing it.
Oldham Athletic's Holden is in your dreams and your nightmares still. It's fascinating, Paul. Fascinating. Yeah. It's lovely talking to you. Paul Parker, his book's called Tackling the Game.